the session on wisdom, Chochmah, and Sophia, as a treatment in looking at wisdom literature in the Old Testament, and as a source for our looking at, during this whole week, of ecological spirituality and ecofeminist approaches in particular. So we'll look at that text through some of the both the literary research that has been done on these texts, and also some of, later on we'll look at some archaeological reality. I have up on the board here our three words that we'll be using mainly in English is wisdom. In the original Hebrew text, and we'll be looking at Proverbs 8, if you can turn to there. We won't read the text just right away. I want to give some introductory materials, introductory thoughts here before we actually read through the text. The Hebrew word is chokhmah, meaning wisdom. And as we'll look at here, in the Hebrew culture, this is a female word. It is looked on as a particularly feminine, wisdom is associated with women. And I'll look at some of the other reasons why that is historically from other texts. There's also, we'll be using the word Sophia, which is from current usage a Greek word, but I have found some connections in my own etymological research on words, in that great, if you get a map in your mind about Greece and Turkey and Persia, those languages really are related, and there are some connections to the Semitic languages, which are a little bit south, I'm facing the wrong way. I should have put Greece, Turkey, Persia, and the Semitic languages a little further south. The old word I put up here, Saf, S-F is really, and it has different vowels in the middle, has two meanings, and one is all in a line, and the other meaning is wool. Now, we know in a lot of the ancient languages there are there's often the same sound that can mean lots of different things. But I thought this was pretty interesting because the writer of some of the later wisdom literature picked up on this in his own language or her own language. We don't know who wrote it. But Yeshua ben Sirach, who wrote the Wisdom of Solomon in the 2nd century BC, used the Greek language and used the word Sophia. And my theory on this, and I don't know if other people have read some related materials about this word, is that, well, what do you think of when you think of all in a line and wool? Yeah, all right. And maybe you may know a little bit more of some of the work with women and weaving, those stories, how that is related to that Proverbs 8 text, how the wisdom feminine persona that's described in there is kind of weaving or creating and putting together in lines the universe in conjunction with the Creator. So we'll get to that. Do you know some more of the, well, like in other cultures?
I'm just thinking that the women started with the weaving and also with agriculture. That was all credited to women in the beginning, and that might have been lines as well in order to their society.
That's right, putting seeds in rows to kind of, thank you. That's a great thought. If you want to, I put this wisdom literature in the great mystical traditions of the world, Jewish mysticism, and later on the apocryphal literature talks about not only, like in the book of Proverbs, half of it is, the last half is how to live in the world. Here are the rules, here's how you treat other people, here's how you raise children, and how what mothers are supposed to do and what fathers are supposed to do. That's the kind of conventional wisdom. And in contrast with the conventional wisdom, we have the more mystical wisdom about origins of the universe and our meaning and in place in time. I'll give an example. One of the stories I wanted to bring out about this in this mystical tradition, kind of a 20th century, or which goes back to the 12th century, in the book The Mists of Avalon, has anyone read this? There is a weaver, or a woman who is a wise woman, who then in her off years in the winter does weaving. And in her weaving, she goes into a trance. And in that trance, that's where she solves problems and gets wisdom for the community. So I think that is just, to me, that's a universal image from a lot of different cultures, that the wise woman who is doing the weaving. And we'll read in some of the biblical texts other examples of wise women in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Let's move right to that. I'll give you three or four examples of early wisdom, how it is associated with women. We remember the story of Miriam who danced. I believe she was associated the sister of Moses. She is considered in the Hebrew tradition one of the first prophets because of her leadership. And the Song of Miriam that is in from the Exodus times. There's another leader named Deborah. Does anyone know the Song of Deborah?
Is she a judge?
Yes. Yeah. My text isn't real clear on these early figures, but it does say here these Miriam and Deborah were first Hebrew sages and those who left concrete memories in the national heritage were women. And we've somehow, in our patriarchal culture, in the European traditions, have somehow just glossed over a lot of these important figures. But these songs of both Miriam and Deborah were used in the worship of the tribes of Israel.
It's Judges chapter 5, and it's a long chapter.
Yeah, it tells about her wise decisions and a tribute to Deborah as a leader in the community. Another one is in first. If you have your Bible and want to read the story, it's a fascinating story. Abigail of Carmel, this was in David's time, she was called a woman of good sense, intelligence, and insight. Her husband's name, I don't know if I should, I'll just give you a short synopsis of that story. Abigail negotiated with King David. Because of the mistake of her husband. I don't know if you remember the story. Her husband's name is Nabal, which means fool in Hebrew. So it may have been a mythical tale of the wise and the foolish. Again, as Jesus even talked about that contrast. Abigail is presented as this model of wisdom. What happened is that David and his merry men, it portrays them almost as Robin Hood. They were guarding or had been out in the wilds, and they happened to cross Nabal's sheep shearers. And there they were out in the middle of nowhere, and I guess there were bands of highway robbers or other people. And they guarded the sheep and the shearings, I guess, for 3 days. And then David and his merry men decided, wait a minute, you know, hey, where's our host here? And, you know, for this service, we expect some hospitality. And he started to get real upset. And Nabal had, even through his messengers, had given no word of any return for that favor. And I don't know if you've heard stories about, there's very strict rules about hospitality in these older cultures. And anyone on anyone else's land that does a favor, or even a visitor, is expected to be lavished with food and comfort, and wine, and the best of the household. And here David was being ignored, even when he'd done this guy a favor. Well, he sent a threat that he would kill Nabal and all of his men and all the sheep shearers and besides, and you know, if he didn't get some hospitality. His macho pride got really inspired there, I guess. And then Abigail heard about that, and her husband was just on a 3-day drunk, I guess. And she went out to David and negotiated with him. If, you know, please, you know, excuse my husband. This was just an oversight. We really want to honor you and all this. And she had brought, oh gosh, if you want to.
What's the reference?
It's in 25:18.
What book?
Oh, 1 Samuel 25:18. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep ready dressed, 5 measures of parched grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs. And, and said, we'll go treat this guy right. And so she saved her husband's life and all the lives of the... and made a friend, by the way. Nabal, if you read the whole chapter... He felt mortified later on and died of a heart attack or something. He was stricken, and he died. And then David then proposed to Abigail. She became his wife. There's one other text I'd like to take a look at, maybe two if we have time. There is an anonymous wise woman from Tekoa in the south. That's in 2 Samuel 14, 1 through 20 is this, the whole text. Now again, I'll try to give a summary. She again did some pretty hefty negotiating. This was after David's one son, Absalom, had left, was banished from the household because he had killed his brother, Amon. And David was pretty upset with Absalom at that point. And so the woman, and there were some friends of Absalom that were going to try to negotiate with David about it, but they talked to the woman, and she came up with a great approach to this. She's the wise woman of Tekoa, never named. She told her story to David and thereby convicted him in his heart. In this way, she said, King, your handmaid had 2 sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to part them, and one struck the other and killed him. And my husband is long since dead, and now the whole family has risen against me and my remaining son, and saying to me, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew. That's the ancient law of a life for a life. And she said that now they are going to destroy the heir also, and thus they would quench my coal, which is left. You know, if you only have one little ember left, you can't start a fire the next day. And if that goes out, you really are in trouble. We will not have our progeny on the face of this earth. And David said, no, I'm sympathetic, and I will send a decree to your town and let no hair of your remaining son's head be harmed. That will be my authority as king. I'll do that for you. And then the woman says, I have one more question. She said, well, okay, why are you doing the same thing in your own family? You are letting your remaining son, your strong son, be abolished, and your progeny will be lost. And she said, and in giving this decision to me, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king has not brought his banished one home again. So, and then King David went and sent a messenger to Absalom, and his family was reunited. So a wise woman again, there's one more story about another wise woman from the town of Abel in 2 Samuel 20, 13 to 22. She did some negotiating again in a war situation. I think it's a different one because the town names are different. Abel, in fact, is quite a bit south. I've been reading all and including my Oxford annotated version has all the geography in it too. So, but we don't have time, I don't think, to go through all of that today. Maybe let's look at that 2 Samuel 20. 13 through 22. Okay. Here we go. In verse 16, a wise woman from the city, and this is the city of Abel. Hear, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. So she spoke with authority. And there is, again, a tradition or a heritage because of our patriarchal culture where we see those in authority as, or we have in the past have seen those in authority as being pretty exclusively male. And I think we've just conveniently left these strands out of our heritage, and now feminist theologians are bringing them back in. She says, in this situation, David, I believe, again, or Joab, one of David's army captains, wanted to destroy the city of Abel, because there was a rebel leader named Sheba in that city. And she went and negotiated again with Joab. And she says, I am one of those, in verse 19, I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a whole city, which is a mother in Israel. Again, that city was known as being a center for wisdom and learning. Why will you swallow up the heritage of Yahweh? Joab answered, well, okay, far be it from me. I just really don't want to destroy the whole thing, but I'm trying to get after this Sheba, your little rebel leader that is rabble-rousing, as they say. And so she negotiated to have Sheba taken out of the city, and then Joab and his men did what they will with Sheba. So, any other questions or any other memories that you have of some other Old Testament texts, or we may get to the New Testament, some of the wisdom in the New Testament text if we have time today too. Any others that you recall? Okay, I do want to keep this kind of to my outline. As biblical scholars, we try to look not only at the canon, this collection of books that were formed in the second century, fourth century, and sixth century, and 12th century, as we, you know, how the church keeps deciding and redeciding what to put in and what is right. But since the discovery of other texts in the archaeology of the Middle East, we have added to our knowledge of these basic texts by looking at some of the texts that are not necessarily included in our, at least in the Protestant tradition. Even in the Roman Catholic Bible, we include the, I mentioned Yeshua ben Sirach, Book of Wisdom. And I'll read a little bit from there. And then we'll go right to the Proverbs 8:22 text. There is indeed a spirit in wisdom. She is intelligent, holy, and unique, multiple, subtle, and mobile, lucid, stainless, and clear, inalterable, loving, and good, diligent, and autonomous, and beneficent. She is able to enact and able to oversee and able to penetrate all spirits, the intelligent, the pure, and the most subtle. Wisdom is more mobile than any physical movement. On account of her purity, she passes through and permeates all things. Can we read then the Proverbs text and see if we see some similarities here?
This is wisdom talking, right?
Yeah. Proverbs 8, verse 22. You all have it before I do here. Somebody want to read from verse 22 through the end of the chapter?
I can. Uh-huh. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth, before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the sons of men. And now, my sons, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways, hear instruction and be wise, and do not neglect it. Happy is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord, but he who misses me injures himself. All who hate me love death.
Okay. Sometimes I include the very beginning of the next chapter. Wisdom has built her house, and she has set up her seven pillars. That, again, it's referring at the wisdom was there at creation. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work. And that feminine persona, that feminine face, was there and influencing, there and still is a delight to God. And then she, with the Creator, in verse 31, also rejoices in the inhabited world and delights in all humanity. That's the inclusive language reading. I want to take a look at a couple of the details of this text. What I want to emphasize is that wisdom was there before the beginning of the earth. He drew a circle on the face of the deep. That's in verse 28 or 27. That means that that refers to that whole horizon. You know, as people looked at how the earth was, they didn't see it as a globe hanging in space as we do today, but as a flat earth with a horizon, as you could see it, just on the, if you're in the flat plains of the Middle East, you can see a circular horizon or the flat plains of North Dakota, where I grew up. What do you notice here? And I'll share with you, the first time I read this, I said, well, what's this doing in here? And what do you notice here that could suggest quite a different view of how we see God's activity, God's creativity in the world? What do you see?
It seems to me that they're somewhat equating wisdom with order,
mm-hmm.
and system.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, by setting things up and building mountains and that, you're putting some structure and some order to it.
Yeah, that's that stuff, all in a line, mm-hmm. all lined up in a way. And yes, setting, assigning the sea its limits, yes. Mm-hmm. And that first part of chapter 9, setting up the seven pillars. The seven pillars in other ancient stories, it says, it supporting a roof, suggesting a banqueting hall of a palace, but also wisdom's house in 8 verse 34 is the world, and the pillars are the pillars of heaven, also referred to in other poetic texts. So she is associated with order in the universe versus chaos.
Rules.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is a main point or a tangent, but pillars, except for this room, you know, that does have some pillars, I don't see that often.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time that this was written, pillars were the way of supporting before you could get to the next level. And,
right.
and didn't the ancient Hebrews think of the earth as one level and hell below and heaven above.
Mm-hmm.
So then, would wisdom's house be equivalent to heaven? Wisdom has built her house. She has set up her seven pillars.
In looking at the other related texts, it said it refers to the space where we live, which, you know, that is, the house is the earth. Then. And in other texts, it refers to the seven pillars that hold the sky up from the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the invisible
dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, pretty important pillars because you don't want the sky falling down.
That's right. Good point. Any other thoughts about how this is a radically different text from other areas of, and maybe other stories or myths that are in the Old Testament of how the world came to be and how, what were its components?
I'd like to follow that. She has that in this order, but also the connectedness of all things.
Yeah.
Things are connected within each other.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that circle is everything is coming around.
Right. That and the new translation in verse 31 is that we, you know, wisdom rejoices in the whole world. And this is, and delights in all humanity. This is quite different than God looking down at one tiny little community, the chosen people of one Semitic tribe in the Middle East. And here wisdom says, we are to rejoice in the whole creation and look at all of the delights of the whole creation, including all of the peoples of the world. So this is quite different than a lot of the texts. There is a theorist that takes, that it says there are a few other texts in the Old Testament that do put they call it. And those are the texts later on this week that I'll be looking at with the ecological spirituality more in mind. Today, I'd like to look at other ramifications of this text. And yeah, what you brought up is pretty central. One of the books that I've used to study this text is, it's called Till the Heart Sings, and it is about mysticism and the poetic language of the Bible. It's beautifully written. It affirms in this book over and over again the presence of the feminine in and through both God's creation and in the plan for an egalitarian society, which in our reading, in our patriarchal readings of all of these texts, we've just missed out on these, again, these little strands that are there if we can search them out. The three points that I wanted to bring out that the book brings out, Proverbs 8:22 links a belief in the masculine order. Yes, God created or an ordered universe, but the feminine part of this creation also emphasized, and her activity at the end of that chapter, as you pointed out, is emphasizing that everything is connected, and we are to look at the whole thing, the whole world and all its people as a unified harmony. If you read Carol Gilligan, the book In a Different Voice, she's looked at a lot of different cultures, but particularly the United States, white male-dominated culture, and contrasted what she says is a women's culture versus a male culture. There are other writers after her that have tried to look at how do we string these together now in a partnership vision, but she does contrast that in her interviews with women and ethical decision making. She said girls and women usually, and this is how we are trained, she says, girls and women try to look at the whole picture and how their ethical decisions affect everybody in the group. And I think girls and women are trained to think that way because they are the emotional caretakers of families in our culture. And in contrast, the males that she interviewed, boys and men, make decisions based on the rules and the order, you know, what comes next and what's supposed to be the way it is. And what are the laws? And if you think about some decisions that you've made, oftentimes looking at the whole picture and how it affects each individual can conflict with what the rules are. And so there we have one of the 10 different ethical dilemmas that Carol Gilligan talks about in her book, In a Different Voice. Second, in this text, one of my main points that I'd like to get to is that it introduced the notion of play within the serious or solemn notion of God and His creation.
Yeah, the rejoicing and delighting, which is so emphasized in 30 and 31, that's even more fun to read than Genesis 1 or 2 that emphasizes, you know, God said it was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's pleasure. That's contentment. God pronouncing that the creation was good.
But rejoicing
and delighting,
yeah.
Sounds even stronger.
Right. And in the very next section, she has a party. She's that excited, and she's going to have a banquet. She's sent out her maids to call to everyone, you know, and especially fools, come in here and learn about wisdom. And aren't we all in need of learning? Leave simpleness and live and walk in the way of insight. I did want to have you look at this continuum, how in our Western societies we often see play on the one side of the continuum and work is on the opposite side of the continuum. And the picture of the weaver, and a lot of my kind of favorite work is play to me. And I'm sure you've heard about some of those lucky souls that have found work in their lives that brings them joy and is just, is play, is fun for them. I'm just starting. I just bought a loom, so I'm going to start to learn to weave. And to me, it's productive work, yes, but there is a creativity in the design. There's, and you can think of a lot of the, a lot of other so-called women's work of, you know, planting the seeds and tilling gardens. There's so much beauty and joy and rejoicing and appreciating all of the, I guess the fun part of, you know, the stuff that we have to do to still survive. But there's some other examples of how, you know, in our society we've set up this kind of dualistic separation between work and play. I think wisdom is telling us, let's get it together here a little better, that there can be that sense of creativity and joy in our work. How do we do that? Is there some hints in the text? Or in some from your own lives, have you found how to approach your life in a creative way?
The body with me is the body's in there. You work it, you find out that both like in just your everyday life and knowing that you have to get some sleep or rest because your body is so strong. You have to go to sleep or your body needs that nourishment.
Listening to the rhythm that we do need.
Your body centered. Keep yourself centered into your body so you know what your body is telling you. And part of our tradition, listening to our body, knowing what our body is listening to.
The wisdom of the body, knowing when it's time to stop doing one thing and do another. That's from the Native American. Yeah, or burnout, yeah, which, you know, don't we see a lot of that in our corporate structures today? Any other thoughts on, yeah?
I think in choices of, you know, careers or occupations or something, I talked to someone once who said that the best thing to do is find something you really enjoy doing and then get someone to pay to do it.
Right.
So that's, you're not going out looking for money and looking for success, but you're looking for fulfillment in your work.
Yeah, that's the toughest fight that career counselors have to do. In my former life, I did that for a while also, that to convince people not to just go into computers or whatever is the popular training course at the time for quick cash, but to find something that really fits with their person and their values. A lot of 18-year-olds don't know, you know, that yet, but they're in that, you know, real important part of their lives of discovering what they're interested in, what is play for us, what is fun. We've really missed out on a lot of that perspective, I think, in this culture.
It makes me remember a worship service, a Vesper service that the Mavericks led about 3 weeks ago. The four of the Mavericks got up to represent the entire team, and they had built, they moved the main altar back, and they had built in its place this circular, this cylinder of stacked wood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had moved it down from where they're stacking wood up above. And one of the main points that was said in Vespers that night was that because Holden allows you to play, work, and worship with the same people, it's easier to integrate that you can play while you work, you can worship while you play, you can worship while you work. I mean, that instead of this distinction of three different activities, they are one. And their other main point was, when we leave Holden, we want to still be able to integrate those three into one. Mm-hmm. It'll be harder than it is here, because you might play with different people than you worship with, whatever. But they said it so well, mm-hmm. that those three could be combined.
Yeah. Our tendency is to have our lives very compartmentalized in the outside world, as they say. Any other thoughts on work and play? And
probably another one following up with you as this girl. During our times over in Chicago, when I worked with the national offices on multicultural ministries, we know we do have more or less work or things that have to be done. So we have found that we do need to sit aside time that we are going to do one thing, mm-hmm. during our session, towards some time during that day to get us away from that mode of just working the 3 or 4 days or how many times, however long we're there, so that we can integrate our body enough to be able to get back to whatever work we were doing. Sort of grow into the play and creativity, sort of getting back to our work, we refresh ourselves.
Right. That creativity has to be nurtured in balance.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to use that word balance. I would have thought of, prior to this study, I would have thought of those things as needing balance, but I wouldn't have thought of those things as needing wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we think of play and work sometimes as opposites. And I think what you're saying is integrate the two and see the playfulness for the enjoyment in work.
No. To me, I'd like to do a little more Hebrew thing and just kind of combine it all into one entity. Mm-hmm. You know, our creativity, whatever kind of gets our juices going.
You can make it a triangle.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. The kind of...
I was just going to say, too, it came to mind. I think kids think of play is the fun stuff you do and work is the stuff that's not fun that you do. But I remember growing up as a kid that sometimes when we got to working on something, that was more fun, and those are the most fun experiences I remember. Is, you know, when we were working, tearing down a house or something, you know, it was actual physical labor, but it was mm-hmm. a lot of fun.
Right. Right, using your body and your mind and creating something new out of the old.
Or digging in the garden.
Oh, yes. And I like what Mark said, just something that's a change of pace is sometimes, yes, it's you know, work and play, but we need that change of pace to kind of keep our creativity going. Something that's different is play. The last, what time is it? My watch is off, and we're supposed to close at what time?
It's 12:30, and we can close anytime you wish.
All right. I want to get to lunch.
60 minutes from 11:40 takes us to 12:40.
Okay.
And lunch is at 1.
All right, so we'll close in about 10, 12 minutes. I think we'll have time enough to do some... getting to some of this other main point that I didn't put on the blackboard, but the author of this book looks at this person, this figure, Wisdom, as a female, the female figure, as an intermediary agent between the transcending sovereign of nature, that's God, as Lord or King, which that is that there is that strand in the Old Testament also. She's a mediator between God and human creatures who are lonesome in their cosmic solitude and in their historical confusion. This is how this guy writes. I'm just like, oh yeah. humans who are lonesome in their cosmic solitude and in their historical confusion. This guy gets to the point of this person being almost a foreshadow of the Christ, who is the great mediator. And that's exciting to me, that there is another feminine face that in all the other research that has been done about Jesus's personality, how many feminine attributes he had, and in his life on earth, and in his wisdom, affirming women in so many ways. In the face of that patriarchal culture that he lived in also. But even as early as this Proverbs was written, probably around the time of, let me look, it was collected during the Babylonian period, when the tribes of Israel were in the first diaspora. That means they were kicked out of their promised land and captured by Cyrus of Persia, and they were in the Babylonian captivity. And that's where many of these texts were consolidated and written down and preserved by the priests and scribes that were in exile. It's oftentimes we'll find that a nation that is in danger will formulate even a stronger and pass on the traditions to their children in even more succinct ways than the more fluid nations that are not oppressed. I think of the Judaic traditions up through today. The rituals and the holidays are very carefully observed, and the tradition is very carefully maintained from thousands of years. And maybe you want to say something about that. How that is important, because it seems in the last 3,000 years or more, the Jewish people have been shot at, from all sorts of other nations. I want to look at a couple of other ways that this author looks at this feminine figure of wisdom. The next idea is that this search for a mediator in the context not of a masculine kind of go-between, as we see later in Jesus, but of a feminine mediator, projects the human experience of womanhood onto the screen of divinity. Now, he uses this poetic language, but how do you understand what he's saying?
Women are mediators and conflict resolvers often. Mm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So for women and men on earth to see someone mediating between God and humanity, to see that as a female figure would
identify with that
experience.
Yeah. And in all those other texts we looked at, the wise woman is the mediator, the negotiator, and brings those skills of conflict resolution into the best, and as we see in Solomon, the best of wisdom is resolving those conflicts between people. That's what the first judges were all about. They also bring another point here, and I do want to have a little discussion about this too, that this text projects the human experience of womanhood and feminine identity onto the screen of divinity. And I guess what I want to ask is, what does it mean that we see, and I guess I want to differentiate between those kinds of religions that have a god and a goddess at the head of the religion, say some of the Greek stories, but that we, in our tradition that we've inherited, see God not only with male metaphors, you know, ruler and king and father, as we've tried to talk about inclusive language here, but also with a definitely feminine face. In that picture of the divine at the beginning of creation, she was there at his side. We don't know what, you know, what does that mean, I guess. What kind of person was she? Some of the scholars try to fill in and bring that person into our current view of the Trinity of God, and looking at the Holy Spirit as a more of the feminine part of God. And in our limited human understanding, we believe that God is a person, an active living source of life. So we see that in our, how we divide human life in male and female. But what would it mean in the church to see that divine person as equally feminine, equally womanish?
Well, for me, in 1993, it doesn't change anything, but it would have been a real radical idea for me back in 73. Because somewhere in the 70s, it was drilled into me from readings and from discussions that, I'm created in God's image. Male and female are all created in God's image. Mm-hmm. Therefore, God, you know, just by connection, it became real obvious that God is either both male and female, or God is neither male nor female. You know, it's a mystery, just like the Trinity,
triune
God,
yeah,
being one God. You know, not kids can get by with saying there's God and then there's Jesus, but anybody over about the age of 10, I won't accept that distinction from, because I have to keep reminding myself that Jesus lived on earth as a human being, but also true God. So anyway, in 1993, the idea that a feminine person or a feminine image existed from before time, that fits right in with what I already believe. It's another way of saying what I believe is true.
That we all are expressions of the different aspects of the divine creativity. That's kind of the last point that this author wants to get across, is again what Mark brought up, is that this text displays a perspective of human universalism beyond the ideology of a particular covenant, election, or divisions, beyond divisions that we put in our communities, in our societies. This text makes us capable and encourages us to embrace within one sweep all the families of the earth. The closing question for discussion would be, how do we honor our separate nationalities or traditions or even religions while we yet honor all of the diverse populations and recognize the rights of all nations to be maybe first we can talk about how do we run into that conflict in our society, in our lives right now.
I think just in terms of being diverse communities with various religions, and even I was on the Native American spirituality thing, and how do you bring that in with Christianity and
the dominant
view,
culture?
Accept one, not the other. Do you accept them all and say this is my path? Or,
yeah. How do we find our own individual path, or our, you know, our maybe little community? You know, that we live and move, and even in retaining family traditions.
You know. Do you see that as fascinating, or as just conflict producing?
Yeah.
There's probably a mix of both at some times, depending on what, you know.
Mm. Are we back to Carol Gilligan talking about the needs of the, you know, individuals versus the needs of the whole, looking at the whole, what's better for the whole group? I'm trying, you know, are we on the same track here?
I don't know if that's exactly.
You're looking at trying to understand and appreciate and honor other cultures, even in, and at the same time as honoring
your own
traditions. Yeah. Where is the conflict there sometimes? Yeah.
I kind of like the idea that I was just reading on further in here in Proverbs, where she says, you prove a wise man and he will love you, give instruction to a wise man and he will still be wiser. Teach a righteous man and he will increase in learning. That nobody really has the answers, but if you add what everybody has to say and let everybody put their word in, that will come up with a truer picture of what is it, what should be.
That all people's voices be heard.
That it's not necessarily you're wrong and I'm right.
Right.
But let's dialogue together and see if we can come up with something.
Ooh, that's a new interpretation of that. I like that. Great. Yeah.
It emphasizes continued learning and that no one knows it all.
I think we have to have that perspective if we are to live in a multicultural community. Mm-hmm. We also must not forget the dynamics that we've learned about if we are, and I am in, and a member of the dominant culture, or the dominant group in the society in some ways. I am not as a female, but I am as a white, mostly white American. And so I have the privilege of just assuming that my voice will be heard. But if you are not in a part of the dominant culture, and you know, I'd like to get away from, you know, instead of looking at this culture as a monoculture, to a pluralistic society and honoring that pluralism and multiculturalism, as we're trying to do in this community this week, that I work so that the oppressed have a voice. And that's what we'll be talking about on Friday. Okay. Yeah, any other?
You were asking about the Jewish tradition.
Yeah.
I find a very common thing that happens is what happened to the state of Israel, starting with the Sabras, who were very dark, and part of the Middle East, and very much their culture is that. And all these European Jews came in World War II and disrupted everything. So their stereotype of what it meant to follow the Jewish religion was broken tremendously, and then had to be re-established in different forms. And then in the 70s or 80s, Ethiopian Jews came in.
To Israel.
And here were completely dark Jews, probably more toward the original, and their practices were very